The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Today on the podcast, Laura Dean, already well known to Lawfare readers as the author of our Cairo Diary. Laura, for those who haven't been following the diary, is a Cairo-based freelance writer who has worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as a journalist and as an election monitor in a number of countries in the region. She's in the United States for a spell, and I reached her by phone in Maine to discuss goings-on in Egypt, the military there, the Muslim Brotherhood, and life amid the revolution.
So, Laura, how does somebody end up being a freelance writer in Cairo in the middle of a revolution?
Well, it's been a bit of a roundabout route. I grew up in Bahrain, which is a small island next to Saudi Arabia, and so have sort of built-in interest, both personal and professional, for the Middle East. Unfortunately, I didn't learn Arabic really growing up, and so I studied it in college, which sort of brought me back again and again to different parts of the region. After college, I did a stint in journalism in D.C. and then ended up working at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, focusing mostly on Middle East issues. And then I was already looking for a way to get back to the region. And then when the sort of uprisings that then came to be known as the Arab Spring started happening, I became almost desperate to get back. And then I found a job working as an election observer, starting out in Tunisia and then migrating over to Egypt. And I eventually ended up in Libya doing that work. I had always wanted to get back to covering the region from a journalistic perspective. And so then when all the elections were over, I sort of moved back towards writing and journalism in the region.
So over the last few weeks, you were out of the country for a little while, and then you went back. And right when you went back, everything exploded. And I'm interested, you've been writing both for Lawfare and for elsewhere about a lot of the awful things that have been going on. I'm curious for your sort of gestalt high altitude impressions. You're back in the United States now for a visit. You're away from it. What's the sort of 40,000 foot view of what's going on in Cairo right now?
It's been interesting to see it from an American perspective because I think it's difficult to differentiate at this distance between, say, what's been going on in Cairo this summer and what's been going on in Iraq or Syria. But it is actually very different, both the sort of lived experience of it and the forces at play. On June 30th, there were protests across the country that had been, being organized a number of weeks in advance. At the time, it seemed to be a largely grassroots youth movement, and they had really kind of gone around the country getting signatures calling for the ouster of Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi. Now it seems that there were perhaps other forces at work. None of that hasn't been unpacked fully, but.
So you don't believe the Tamarod demonstrations were a sort of spontaneous, Arab Spring-like uprising. They were. You think there was a sort of more military involvement from the beginning than then appeared?
I think it's hard to say whether or not it started out as a grassroots movement that was then sort of co-opted by security forces and, old regime types, or whether or not it was planned by those forces to begin with. I, at this point, we don't know, and may never know. That said, there were many people who came down to the streets on June 30th and who signed the petition who did really want something different from their government and really did want Mohamed Morsi to leave office. So it wasn't, those people were not coerced. Those people were very much supporters of the movement. But as far as its organization and, getting the numbers that they got, although even those numbers, it's difficult to know how many people came to the streets since the estimates we have are largely military estimates. Yes, I think that given how wide-ranging it was, given how many people came to the streets, it's difficult to believe at this point that it was just a grassroots movement similar to January 2011.
From outside, it looks like the military had gotten what it wanted. And to the extent that there was a grassroots movement, the grassroots movement had gotten what it wanted. That is, Morsi was out. There was a military regime with a civilian veneer in place in a transitional capacity. And then after that, it turns into a bloodbath. And I'm interested for your thoughts on why that happened, to what extent it was necessary for any purpose, and to what extent it was simply a war between two rival political cultures, one of which sort of slaughtered the other.
That's been one of the more difficult things to understand in the last 7-8 weeks. I really don't think it needed to get as violent as it did. I think a lot of this started around November, December in 2012, when Morsi's government forced through a very unpopular constitutional declaration. And there were a lot of people killed in peaceful demonstrations around that time. And I think that's when the media and a lot of people who voted for them, for the Muslim Brotherhood, started to turn against them. And really since then, there's been a lot of criticism of the Muslim Brotherhood in the media. So that's one thing. The groundwork was sort of being laid long before June 30th. And then I think it also became clear that the Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters, and even a lot of people who felt that Morsi's ouster was undemocratic and a bad precedent to set in a fledgling democracy, it became clear that those people were not just going to kind of go quietly and go home and stay quiet. And so then two very large sit-ins were set up, and thousands of people were camped out. People had come in from the Delta, from Upper Egypt, even from Sinai. And so it became clear that the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi supporters were forced to be reckoned with, and they were not going to submit to the army's will. And then after that, sort of the media campaign intensified, and the Brotherhood and Morsi supporters were completely dehumanized. They were referred to as terrorists, which made it so that when the army did crack down, the narrative was that they were killing terrorists and this was a reasonable thing to do. And, there were very few independent voices in the media, and many people believed that it was a necessary thing.
We have had in this country over the last few years large sit-in demonstrations that won't go away as well, and that don't accept, the rule of the security forces, though we don't, obviously don't have that name for them. Mm-hmm. And the general rule about things like Occupy Wall Street or Occupy DC is you wait them out, right? And so I guess the question is, why was the military just unwilling to let a lot of people, you know, sit in those two demonstrations for long periods of time, and eventually they'd get bored and go home.
I very much wish they had decided to wait them out. It is sort of difficult to understand because it would seem that as you, you know, the more time you give them, the more people sort of get bored with the story and kind of move on, or people go home because they have to feed their children and go back to their jobs. I think it's a number of things. I think the military really saw this as their chance to stamp out the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, there's been antagonism between these two bodies for decades, since Nasser, if not before. And so that was one thing. I think they saw that there was enough, the military saw there was enough public, that the Brotherhood had fallen so low in public estimation and public opinion that there really wouldn't be much pushback from wider society for if there were, when there's a crackdown. Also, I think there was an element of sort of face-saving to it, that there was a lot of talk that before they dispersed the sit-ins that, you know, this was making the military look bad, was making them look weak. One argument that people make that I don't think holds much water is that it was particularly the larger sit-in at Rabada Dawaya was in a neighborhood where, you know, it was in a very residential neighborhood, and it was making life difficult for people who lived in that neighborhood, you know, if be that as it may, it doesn't justify the slaughter of, you know, over 700 people. But these are a number of the arguments sort of swirling around. I think the one I think that's the most, holds the most water for me is the one about it seems like an opportunity to really weaken the Muslim Brotherhood as a political force.
You know, so when Americans talk about what's going on in Egypt now, there's always a sort of understanding that there's no good guy in these in this relationship. That is, there's nothing attractive about a military dictatorship, and there's nothing attractive about the Muslim Brotherhood as a ruling party. Mm-hmm. And the question always reverts to which is the worse option. And I guess my question is that the right way to think about the question of the next few years of governance in Egypt, or is there a more useful and nuanced way to think about what the options are for the United States to hope for and work for? Or is it just not up to us in any meaningful sense, and we sort of should just get used to the idea that we'll take whatever happens on the street as the groundwork against which we're operating?
I think it really isn't up to us, and I think the last 6 weeks have really shown us that. And as I understand it, most diplomats in the West were under the impression that the sit-ins were going to be dispersed much more slowly, and it was a last-minute internal decision that was not shared with international interlocutors in any way to disperse them sort of violently and quickly. I think that it's become clear that the U.S. doesn't have as much leverage in Egypt as maybe as the U.S. thinks it does, but also as sort of people in Egypt think that we do. I mean, there are conspiracy theories on both sides, there are from supporters of the army and supporters of the Brotherhood. The Morsi supporters accuse the U.S. of supporting a coup and, you know, continuing to work with what they see as an illegitimate government, while the army supporters say that, you know, the U.S. supports what they call terrorism, they support the Muslim Brotherhood.
Now, how did that happen? I mean, you know, I have seen lots of incidents in which the United States is, you know, unpopular for conflicting set of reasons. But I'm not sure I've ever seen a situation before in which there seems to be as much certainty from two competing and antagonistic political forces that the United States is the power behind the throne of the other side.
It's actually quite a common situation in the Middle East, in my experience, just because sort of the U.S., no one ever believes that the U.S. is well-intentioned, and the U.S.'s intentions are always to preserve its own interests, so there's no reason why you know, they should assume that. But I think it was it goes back to a speech that was given by Ann Patterson leading up to June 30th, which was sort of encouraged. It's been a while, and I forget the exact text, but it was something along the lines of encouraging Egyptians to adhere to democratic principles and not overthrow their democratically elected leader. And there was also a meeting with one of the major financiers of the Muslim Brotherhood, Qaid al-Shatir, in that time, and people react to that very badly. And then obviously the fact that the U.S. continues to work with the interim government and the military, the Brotherhood take that as evidence that they support them. But I think also there's a perception that the U.S. is much more involved behind the scenes at a very sort of granular level in Egypt than they actually are. Also, I think there's a very long history of, the powers that be manipulating the Egyptian public for their own gains. I think the Brotherhood is very much guilty of that, and sort of, convincing large swaths of Egyptian people from the Delta who come in to support them that it was reasonable 6 weeks after his ouster to think that Morsi was going to come back when the rest of the world and the rest of Egypt had decided that that was very much not going to happen. And then the military calling, on several occasions this summer, they've called people to the streets to support action that they were taking against Morsi supporters. There was a particular instance it was after the Republican Guard massacre. It was the second round of killings before the dispersal, where the army called people into the streets to quote unquote support potential terrorism, and so to give themselves the perception, at least, of a mandate to then, engage violently with the Muslim Brotherhood on the streets.
So one of the really striking things to me as I watch this is how many people who 2 years ago were out in the streets, essentially calling for an end to military rule, either in the form of the Mubarak administration or subsequently for the SCAF, the transitional military government, are now suddenly enthusiasts of military rule and are saying all kinds of seemingly, quite deranged things about what it is okay for the military to do out of fear of the Brotherhood. And I'm curious how you read that transition, psychologically for a lot of secular Egyptians, but also what the mirror side of it is on the Brotherhood side.
I think it's a number of things. I think there's a lot of frustration that the economy hasn't improved, that the many people are unhappy with the constitution, that many of the things that they fought for during the 2011 uprisings, people feel like that was not achieved under a democratic government. And people feel there's a lack of security and that somehow the army brings stability. I think there's a perception that under General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, it's a different staff, it's a different military. There's very much a cult of personality around him. He is extremely popular. I think a lot of more sort of secular or liberal Egyptians fear the Muslim Brotherhood and a more sort of Islamist government. But that said, that was not the majority of people in Tamarud, and they're actually quite a small minority in Egypt. And I think also a number of the sort of secular liberal types, again, they're a minority, are sort of going back on their original support of the military. I mean, most notably, Israh Abdel Fattah. She was one of the founding members of the April 6th movement, very involved in the uprisings in 2011. She and another activist, Asma Mahfouz, were recently charged with spying for foreign bodies, I believe, earlier in the week. And, at least Israh was one of the most outspoken supporters of the military. So I think
the military in the current crackdown?
In the current crackdown, yes.
So why is the military
at least in the lead up to August 14th. I'm not sure about after that.
I see. I mean, is the basic explanation here that you know, you have a sort of radicalization of two camps who have always been mutually suspicious, or is it not that symmetrical?
I think in the sort of anti-Muslim Brotherhood pro-military camp, that is what happened, but it was also a very deliberate radicalization process that very much tied into sort of the state and independent news channels and the shutting down of the Islamist-affiliated channels, and it very much, you know, the interim government and the army became, and the media sort of became one voice, and it became very difficult to access other sources of information. And I think that sort of that fanned flames what people were already feeling, and that, you know, intensified fear and frustration with Morsi and his supporters. On the other side, I think all of the violence this summer can't but have a radicalizing effect. And I've heard a number of sort of older generation, the Brotherhood, saying, well, we're going to continue to be peaceful. We can't control the younger generation. We can't control the people who don't remember, you know, the 90s. And, you know, there are sort of threats that I've heard of violence. But I don't think – I think the leadership of the Brotherhood was perhaps was definitely more radical. I think – the sort of bulk of the people at the sit-in were at the beginning not quite as radicalized, and then became so over the course of the 6 weeks they spent at Daba, all the violence that they saw. And so now I think what you have is two kind of very intransigent, radicalized camps. But I think it actually happened quite recently.
Uh-huh.
Although I think it started on the anti-Morsi side, it started in November, December of last year.
So one of the things, whenever somebody reads the Cairo diary or, you know, and asks me about it, the thing that they always start with is, you know, what is she doing there? It's got to be really dangerous to be going around talking to all these people. You've spent a lot of time at Rabah with the Brotherhood people, talking to, you know, a lot of people of very diverse backgrounds and views. What's the atmosphere like for a, you know, working journalist in Cairo now, for, you know, Western organizations, and particularly one who's young and female?
I think that has changed quite dramatically in the last 2 weeks, and there has been a lot of targeting of journalists, both foreign and Egyptian. Most of that has been by the security forces, because I think the narrative in Western news outlets has been more sympathetic to the Brotherhood than and much more so than the Egyptian news, and the security forces and the interim government are very unhappy with that. So there's been, you know, some sort of threatening and intimidation of journalists. Day to day on the street, I've been fortunate, and I've had very positive interactions with people. I mean, going to Rabah al-Adawiya, I was nervous the first time, but people there really wanted to talk to the media. They wanted to tell their story, and Egyptian news outlets were not paying attention to them. So people were very happy to talk. Also, it's a more conservative group of people, and so as a young woman, I felt very safe there, even in crowds. You know, I felt that I was very sort of, people were looking out for me in a strange way. I mean, one night, the thousands of people were praying together. It was after evening prayers during Ramadan, and so it was just sort of wall-to-wall people, and it was a small group of us trying to get out, and a woman took my hand, and we were sort of squeezing through essentially a crowd of thousands and thousands of men. And, you know, we were very much sort of respected and I felt very safe. That in Tahrir Square, there has been more harassment around June 30th. There were a lot of there was a lot of harassment, a lot of sexual assaults that took place. I think that's largely because it's in the center of downtown. It's a more diverse group of people than anyone can sort of wander in. But you know, in terms of talking to Egyptians, are still, you know, it's a very friendly, warm society that tends to be warm towards foreigners, despite this kind of wave of xenophobia that has sort of hit in the last couple of weeks.
2 years ago, there were big demonstrations calling for the dismantling of a police state. Now there's a great deal of popular enthusiasm for and a cult of personality around a general in sunglasses, a apparent restoration of a much more aggressive police state than ever existed under Mubarak, just in terms of its willingness to kill people in the streets. How should we understand what's going on there in terms of the level of repression that people are willing to cheer for?
I think it's very worrying. As you said, it does seem to be much more blatant than under Mubarak, and there isn't an attempt to even present a face to the world that it isn't a police state, or that they're not paying lip service to the human rights of people that they don't agree with, like the Brotherhood. They're just calling them terrorists and to sort of strip them of any of those rights. And I think it's already, I mean, the charging of these two activists who are actually supporters of the army is indication that they're sort of trying to quell any potential dissent in the future. The harassment and threatening of journalists, there's an independent movement within the judiciary that issued a statement against Morsi's ouster. It was mixed, and I think some of them are Islamist sympathizers, but the majority are sort of young judges who felt that the Morsi's ouster was undemocratic. So really, in a lot of different quarters of society, the military are flexing their muscles and saying that they're really at this juncture not brooking any dissent, and which is, I think, very worrying, especially since I lived in Egypt briefly under Mubarak in 2007, and the biggest change at sort of the level of people and the level of the street was the way people talked about politics, and all of a sudden people were free to express their opinions and speak freely. And it does, I worry that that might not be the case under this new government that doesn't seem to tolerate any kind of dissent.
And do you see any particular rays of hope and bases for optimism, or is it sort of as bleak as it looks from the outside, where you see two rival and essentially undemocratic forces, one of which has, you know, a mass following, and the other of which has an army?
I see hope in very sort of small people-driven ways. I think people have had the experience of what it feels like to live in a society where there is some level of freedom of expression, and I think people will be unwilling to give that up. I think that a lot of the sort of activist type haven't yet been vocal, but I think that they will go back to being opposed to the military government and all that it brings with it. That said, though, it's a sort of grim time, and I hope that something emerges that presents sort of a third way forward. But right now it's very polarized and very sad.
One last question. Why, given that, do you want to go back?
Because it's the society that I have come to know and want to continue to get to know. And I really enjoy living in Egypt. I mean, it's a society in which humor is very important, and it's a very warm, welcoming place to live. And I feel attached to the place and attached to people that I've made friends with and become close to. And I want to see what the next chapter in this story is and try to understand it better.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.